You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby, where you can engage with us via our website at cjsf.ca or on our social media, which is CJSF Radio on TikTok and Blue Sky, or CJSF Music and CJSF Talk on Instagram.
Talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemon.
Good morning, and welcome to CJSF 90.1 FM. You're listening to Campus and Community Radio broadcasting from Burnaby on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem Nations. I'm your host, Nicole Hines, and I hope you guys are doing very well this morning. The weather has been kind to us for sure. Today, I am excited. I have guests again in the studio. But before I get into our conversation, I just want to share an event that is actually happening this Sunday, August the 16th. Earlier this week, I chatted with Caroline and Leaf with PACE Society about the recent changes that the Vancouver Police Department made to the sex work enforcement guidelines. I'll be airing our conversation on Intravenous next Wednesday, so be sure to be back for that. But today I want to share info about their barbecue fundraiser that will be raising funds for PACE happening on Sunday, August 16th from 2 to 6. And that's going to be happening at the Birdhouse. The Birdhouse is located at 44 West 4th Avenue, and that is West 4th Ave and Manitoba Street. So it will be an afternoon to be in community, play games, and eat some barbecue. I love barbecue. And there will be some sexy hot dog eating contest as well. So definitely make sure you get out for that. If you don't already know, PACE Society is a peer-driven organization that provides support, advocacy, and education by, with, and for current and former sex workers in so-called Vancouver. They will have meat and vegan options, so everybody will be taken care of on the barbecue. There's going to be a bunch of games galore. There's going to be merchandise sales and a 50-50 draw. And so it is very encouraged that you register through Eventbrite just to help to ensure that the venue is in the know of how many people are showing up, and it also helps PACE Society plan for food and other supplies. So I definitely will include the Eventbrite link in the show notes today. And if you're interested in competing in the sexy hot dog eating contest, please email Nathan Erickson. Oh, sorry. It's nath.erickson@gmail.com by August the 16th. I will put the email in the show notes as well. And make sure that when you are sending that email off, you put hot dog in the subject line. So let us break for a song. And when we are back, I will be talking about senior safety and understanding elder abuse. So here is Paper Wings with the song Fumbling. Anymore.
want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to CJSF 90.1 FM. So, back in June, I attended a virtual session led by Linda Yauch from Seniors First BC in collaboration with Burnaby Crime Prevention Services, and it was called Keeping Seniors Safe, Understanding Elder Abuse. And today, Linda Yauch, along with her colleague Tina Chang, are here to chat about the organization Seniors First BC, and we'll also talk a bit about elder abuse and how to respond and, you know, report concerns. So I want to thank you, Linda, as well as Tina. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you so much, Nicole, for inviting us. I'm Linda, and my role with Seniors First BC is doing public education and outreach. So I do presentations like the one that you heard, and very happy to be here to talk more about the topic and what we do at Seniors First.
Absolutely. And Tina?
Thank you for having us. My name is Tina, and I'm the manager for our Seniors Abuse and Information Line and our Victim Services Program. And, you know, we'll be talking a bit more about what our programs can offer.
Absolutely. So before I get into the session that I sat through, could we talk a little bit about Seniors First BC for those who are hearing for the first time?
Of course, and I actually find that many people aren't aware of us, so I really appreciate this opportunity. Seniors First BC is a charitable nonprofit organization, and we've been operating for over 30 years. We're in our 32nd year now. We've had different names and structures, so people might know us other names, but mainly what we're doing is providing information, legal advocacy, and support for older adults, and this is across BC, not just in the Lower Mainland, about issues affecting their well-being. And it's also for people who are involved with an older adult who might have concerns.
Absolutely. And my question next is, what is the age range that a senior is considered to be? Because when I was younger, I always thought like a senior was 65, considered a senior was considered, you know, a senior at 65, but like all across the board. And it didn't start to change slightly for me until like going to like Shoppers Drug Mart and stuff like that, and then they would have like a different age. But you know, when you think of your organization, what is a senior categorized at? What ages?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we see older adults at 55 and up. So anyone who is 55 and up can definitely connect with our services and access our services that are free of cost. Yeah.
Absolutely. And what are some of the services that you offer?
So we have four main program areas, and the main entry point and the one thing that if people keep one thing in mind, it would be our phone line. So that's the Seniors Abuse and Information Line, and Tina's the manager for that. Mm-hmm. We also have a Victim Services Support Program. We have legal services. We can talk a bit more about that. And then we have public education and outreach.
Okay. All right. Awesome. And for those who are listening, we will get into like how you can be connected with Seniors First BC and all of the things, just in case you require some support. But I now want to kind of shift a little bit back to the session that I sat through, and it was talking about understanding elder abuse. Could we maybe like share exactly what elder abuse is?
Okay, that's a really good question, and it's not a straightforward answer in the sense. So here's something that I believe I mentioned in that presentation, but many people aren't aware. Under the Canadian Criminal Code, we don't have a crime that's called elder abuse. We have one for children, which means then everybody's required to report on that. Instead, with elder abuse, there's crimes associated with the abuse of older adults. So that would include things like stealing, forgery, physical assault. The ones that are not so much related, they don't have a specific crime attached to them, are things like the emotional abuse, gaslighting, infantilization, so treating someone or speaking to them like they're a small child. We generally think of, there's many kinds of abuse, but in general, there's six main areas we consider. So the physical one, which is probably what most people think of.
Yes.
The emotional or psychological. There's neglect. So if somebody's supposed to be caring for an older adult and they're not, and that results in harm. Self-neglect can also occur if an older adult is in a situation where they're not able to care for themselves and that results in harm. Sexual abuse does happen. We never like to think about that, but it does occur. And then financial abuse, which is a really huge area.
And what are some warning signs? So let's say you are, maybe it's a loved one, maybe it's a neighbor, and you are in, you know, the community with older adults. What would be some warning signs of elder abuse?
I'm just going to sort of change the question slightly talk about risk factors, because then that can show up, and then I'll talk about one of the warning signs too. But there's many risk factors that can contribute to the development of elder abuse. And I use the word development in that elder abuse doesn't just happen suddenly overnight. Right. Although, yes, we do see in the news about, you know, a physical assault on somebody or scams.
Right.
But generally, things kind of happen over time, and there's different vulnerabilities. So the two big ones, though, are social isolation and dependency. And there's a lot more awareness now and research about isolation, meaning that abuse doesn't get noticed then. So that's kind of a warning sign, if you will, where if you have a neighbor or someone you know and you're not seeing them coming out of their house, that could be something to think about.
Right.
Other things can be somebody is like family dynamics can contribute a lot to communication barriers, and not just language, but also having access to a phone or a computer to reach out for help, or having a physical situation. You know, maybe someone's had a stroke or Parkinson's and they can't verbalize to someone what's happening. Do you want to add something, Gina, about warning signs?
Or? For sure. Definitely, you know, health challenges and disabilities can be a barrier for older folks in reaching out for support and, you know, getting help for themselves. And obviously that can pose another layer of challenge to getting support.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so with your organization, is it like, can anybody who is, you know, 55 and up kind of go and seek out services, or does there have to be any referrals?
Great question. So the reason I mentioned our phone line, that's the Seniors Abuse and Information Line. Anybody can call. Okay. And regardless of age, you don't have to be the older adult who's affected in order to call. Okay. Many of our calls, and Tina can add to this too because she manages the line, but many calls are people who are concerned. And whether it's a family member or a neighbor or a friend, a caregiver, even a service provider is concerned about an older adult, and they can call in. And what happens, maybe I'm speaking for you, Tina, but what happens when people call into the line, they don't even have to identify themselves. It can be anonymous. So it's a confidential phone line where the staff will listen to what the question or the concern is, and then they can offer referrals that might be to one of our other programs like the Victim Service or Legal and or out into the community, you know, to provide supports for people. So in terms of the phone line, anybody can call and should.
Yes.
And definitely, you know, adding on to what Linda said, it can be, you know, a neighbor, you know, someone that you're concerned about or someone that you saw on the streets and you might have concerns about whether they, you know, where can you report? Where can you get further assistance to ensure this person gets the help that they need? So we are technically, you know, really a first step to reporting as well. You know, if you're not sure where to report, how to report, where to start, you know, we can help you navigate the system.
Wonderful. And so, you know, I would say that, you know, reporting by contacting the number is a great way to respond to elder abuse, or to, you know, if you have some concern. But are there any other ways, effective ways as well? Like if you want to respond to elder abuse or report concerns, is there other things that people can do?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, one of the concerns that comes up with reporting is, you know, how can I ensure that I support this person, but I don't want to be involved.
Yes.
You know, I don't want to disclose who I am, things like that. And that's what we also provide information about, you know, to help them navigate, you know, within their comfort, right? Within their comfort level as to, you know, what's the most appropriate way that they can still support this person and ensure this person gets support, but we still respect their decisions, you know, to not be involved. So those are common things that comes up on sale. And yes, we definitely help people navigate that as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And before I let you go, because I am going to share how we can get connected with Seniors First BC, but is there anything else that we may not have touched on about the organization or even about elder abuse that you'd like to share?
I'd like to just add that we get about 8,000 calls a year to the Seniors Abuse and Information Line, but not all of those calls are directly concerns of abuse. So people can call it's not only if there's a concern of abuse or neglect, but when I mentioned about the dependency issue, for example, in isolation, is that often people need support. So we're trying to find ways to help them become less dependent on somebody, to gain more independence and to support them so that we're preventing or reducing the possibility of elder abuse or to keep things from escalating.
Absolutely. And okay, now to the question. How can people get connected with Seniors First BC, whether they want to just know about it, maybe refer to somebody in their life, or just have it on standby, so to speak?
Sure. I'm just going to give the 1-800 number.
Yes.
We have a local number, but I think it's better if just people have one to hang on to.
100%.
And it works in Vancouver and anywhere in BC. Is 1-866-437-1940. And we're not a crisis line, but our lines are open from Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. at the moment until 4:30 p.m.
Okay.
Except for holidays. We can offer language interpretation. So if somebody prefers to speak in another language other than English, they just need to say the language.
Nice.
We'll connect the call to an interpretation service and continue the call in a three-way
manner.
Awesome. If someone's not able to make a call, they can reach out by email, and that's monitored by the phone staff. And it's info@seniorsfirstbc.ca.
Awesome.
And finally, our website is www.seniorsfirstbc.ca. And on there, you'll find a whole lot of information. Particularly, we didn't really talk about legal services, which are also there to support people. You can find out about the different areas that we help with that, too.
Sounds good. And I do have one last question. With regards to, like, you know, as a person who is aging, I find that I am ensuring that I'm seeing my doctor regularly and staying up to date with checkups and such. Is the organization well known within the medical community as well? Because you did talk about legal aspects of things, but does the medical community kind of know a lot about the fact that you have services?
Do you want to take that one, Tina?
I think we are well connected within the healthcare sector in multiple ways. You know, we work with the different, because we're a province-wide agency, so, you know, we cover pretty much all the health authorities, and we connect quite regularly with them as well, specifically the designated responding team, who responds to reports of adult neglect and abuse and self-neglect.
Wonderful. Again, okay, so I want to thank you for joining me, Linda and Tina. I appreciate your insight, your information. I will include all the ways to connect in the show notes today. So if you were walking and enjoying the sunshine this morning, no stress. You'll be able to get that information as well. And now I'm going to break for with another song. We are going to hear a ski team with a track called Gilroy. Again, thank you so much for joining
me. Thank you very much, Nicole.
Thank you.
Don't stop me, I sprang up like a weed in the valley. Climb pretty. Don't blame me, you've always liked the way I get done what you need. Big city. I could go remote. Take a chance at keeping all that I hold close. I like to travel light. Turn off the Wi-Fi and be somebody else tonight. You scare me, gap is getting too big to see. What's down there? Step over bodies on the path and make gaps that I'm spouse cheap.
Welcome back to Intravenous. You've been tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, broadcasting from the unceded Coast Salish territories. UBC midwifery professor Dr. Saraswathi Vadam is here with me in the studio today to talk about a national project that she led along with a team of research, clinical, and community partners called Research Examining the Stories of Pregnancy and Childbearing in Canada Today. Thank you, Dr. Vadam, for joining me today. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm fine. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. Can you give us an overview about the national study?
Yeah, so the study began when we were funded by the Canadian Institute of Health Research back in 2018. Before we even began the study and to get the funding, we worked with a multi-stakeholder group of people, including service users, to try and understand the experience of pregnancy and childbirth in Canada. We knew that's what we wanted to study because we had done it, a national study like that. We had done a provincial study in BC and had enormous response. Mm-hmm. And then we were asked to bring those same study tools to the U.S., and we expanded the ways we could ask questions and understand. And most in the BC study, we were talking about what people's preferences for care were and what they knew about different models of care and how they made decision making, and then things like respect and autonomy. Mm-hmm. When we went to the U.S., they said, "This is all great, but you also need to talk about mistreatment and how we were we were specifically working with communities of color there and people who chose to have community births. So those are two different populations. We thought we'd be doing two different studies. This was some years ago. Mm-hmm. Turns out everybody who experiences pregnancy and childbirth are really talking about the same things, about autonomy, self-determination, what they expect going in to a parenting experience, mm-hmm. and what actually happens,
right.
and the gap, mm-hmm. when there is a gap. And we found in the U.S. and in B.C. that it was not even across different communities, and that, in fact, with marginalized and historically excluded or underrepresented populations, there were not only disparities which have been reported by other researchers in outcomes, but there's also disparities in the lived experience.
Okay.
So then we asked, we came back to Canada and said, should we do this, you know, not just in BC, but, you know, Canada-wide. There had been a previous study done almost 20 years ago now called the Maternity Experience Survey.
Okay.
But they only had one or two questions that really focused in on this concept of respect.
Okay.
Respect is something that people all over the world have been talking about. The WHO has been studying it. Much of that work has been done in low-resource countries and very little in high-resource countries. So mm-hmm. we wanted to understand what's happening in Canada. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's different. Maybe we can learn something from there, because we did find these very disturbing disparities in the U.S. And colleagues of mine who used our measures found it in other countries also. So we said, let's bring it home.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did we find?
Yeah, so we found, in fact, I should say that we worked for 2 years to decide what to study, how to ask the questions,
right.
what were the right ways to ask those questions that would be, get at things and ideas and experiences that hadn't been reported before.
Okay.
Because we were really centering the voice and the experience from the service user's perspective. So not what was observed, mm-hmm. but what people said about their lived experience.
Right.
And so they helped us. We went around the world and found all kinds of ways this concept of respect was being measured. The WHO had worked with some researchers to describe what they called mistreatment,
mm-hmm.
and they described it across seven domains, so including things like informed decision making or autonomy, stigma, discrimination, health systems, respect and disrespect, and that's an
okay.
important thing. Like,
yes.
it's not always just about interaction between a person and their healthcare provider.
Right.
It's also
the system.
It's the system and the access and what's available.
Mm-hmm.
So we gathered all those items. We had about 300 items, and of course we couldn't. And some of those were prompts for doing what's called focus groups, where they talk to a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew that with such a large country and so many different populations that it wasn't really practical to do a lot of focus group conversations, because that would then be the exclusion of getting a really much larger set of people to tell us. So we took 2 years to develop this a survey instrument and also prompts for meeting people where they were in their communities, at their health centers, or the community health workers that were working with different populations. We knew we wanted to make sure we had robust representation from people who had not yet been able to tell their story.
Yes.
We actually took a year just to decide on the name of the study, you know, and that's because we wanted the input of the people who were in our steering council, their community steering council, who were representative of different populations and communities that hadn't been able to tell their story. So we had, you know, the study was for all Canadians, and we recognize that people have many identities. So, you know, you may, you know, live rurally and be Indigenous or be white. You may be, you know, Black and Indigenous. Mm-hmm. You might be somebody who is in a sexual or gender minoritized community, but, you know, have economic challenges, or be an academic, right? So they,
of course,
people aren't just one thing.
Right.
So we wanted to be able to represent that. So in addition to finding what we call validated ways, reliable ways to answer, we worked with people to describe the what happened to them, like if they were wearing a symbol of their religious or cultural identity. If they, these ideas didn't come from the researchers. They came from the people.
People.
This is what you need to ask, and this is what has happened. What about if someone walks in and to the room and doesn't introduce themselves? They just start looking at my chart.
Right.
Or they've been called in by my primary provider, and they're a specialist, and they come to examine me without really asking permission or explaining why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
What about if they tell me I have to make a decision but don't take the time to explain the options and whatnot? So they themselves identified a lot of things that hadn't really come out in the details of what respect looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the seven domains of mistreatment. The other interesting thing is, and particularly the indigenous people in our team and our both in, as researchers and as steering council members, they said, well, we don't need another study to say that there are disparities. We know that. That's mm-hmm. our lived experience. Mm-hmm. We don't need another study to talk about how we're treated differently. That has been done in reports and in our communities. We want to know, what are we going to do about it?
Absolutely.
And in order to know that, we also have to ask questions about what does supportive, kind, exceptional
look like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we added those. So we ended up having about 17 domains of questions.
Wow.
Cultural safety, health systems, barriers, health systems, you know, things that were facilities, things that, you know, whether or not they had family involvement. So lots of different aspects, or what we call domains, of what can make someone feel respected or disrespected.
Exactly.
So we launched, we were ready to, it took us a long time to build something that was reliable and to test those items. And so we were ready to launch in April of 2020.
Okay.
And so to answer your original question, we were originally going to do it in a multimodal way, but that was, of course, the beginning of COVID.
Of course.
We had to stop, and we said, can we do this? And the people we had been working with for 2 years said, well, you have to do it. It doesn't matter. This is still important.
Yes.
So we took a few months to shift everything to online data collection.
Okay, because I was going to ask about how the collection, you know, came to be. So it was online that time frame.
It was from July of 2020 to February of 2022, so about a year and a half.
Okay.
We opened it for a year and found that we did have representation from all provinces and territories, mm-hmm. but because during that period of time, as you might recall, that was during the time that George Floyd's murder happened. It was also during the time when the discovery of unmarked graves here in Canada, and the communities that we knew needed to be represented were experiencing a lot of very, very huge life challenges. And so we decided to extend the data collection by another 6 months.
Okay.
And also to give people an option of two pathways, a sort of a core data set and a more detailed data set.
Right.
We were stunned that we got what we did. You know, we got 6,096 people who participated. And even during that time. So clearly it's very important to people to tell these stories. The name of the study, which you mentioned, Research Examining the Stories of Pregnancy and Childbirth in Canada Today, in part was done because they pointed out that you have to have a study name that makes people know why they are, that they're able to tell their story. So mm-hmm. it's very transparent,
mm-hmm.
but also something that makes them feel like they're being heard. So the first letters all spell out respect.
Exactly.
Right? So now it's known as the respect study.
Absolutely. And let's talk a little bit about the findings. So now we kind of know the journey of the study itself. And what were some of the findings?
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that we think of, and Canada has a global reputation of being a courteous and civil society, and in many respects it is,
mm-hmm.
but apparently for all populations that responded to the survey, there is a disturbing amount of mistreatment. Mm-hmm. So you can say in any given country that you have things like, you know, what's expected about autonomy or even respect. And overall, you could say, okay, there's an average amount of respect that people encounter in the street or in the healthcare system or, you know, autonomy, that we believe in people's autonomy. But how is that really played out? Is it different when you're making a decision in healthcare versus, you know, whether or not what school your child goes to? Is it different whether you are making a decision about cancer treatment or heart treatment or having a baby?
Right.
And that's what we found, that in fact that there is a, particularly with autonomy, there are some things we really need to look at our system about whether the system itself allows people enough time and enough relationship and to have those conversations that let them feel like they are involved mm-hmm. in decision making. Mm-hmm. Similarly, we found that across all populations, 51% of the participants reported at least one form of mistreatment. And that's really disturbing because autonomy and respect are one thing, but mistreatment is, these are the human rights violations. Yeah. So there are 7 items that they responded to in the study. And there were actually 4 additional items which they responded to, which weren't part of our previously validated scale. And now we have 11 items. It's called mistreatment 11. So there are things like, my healthcare provider shouted at me, scolded me, refused my request for help, delayed response to help, that my physical privacy was violated, or my healthcare providers told me that something bad would happen to myself or my baby if I didn't agree to do what they want. I was forced to sign legal documents, to comply to surgery. So things that really shouldn't be happening, mm-hmm. And it's important to understand that this was a person-centered care, and the items were people were reports, what we call patient-reported experience items. So patient-reported, we have all heard about patient-reported outcomes.
Yeah.
And those are important, but mostly those are clinical outcomes. And so there's a different kind of measure called PREMS, patient-reported experience measures. And you have to, things like something like autonomy, you can't just ask them, well, did you have autonomy or not? Right. What does that mean, really? And so we have this more detailed 7-item way of measuring that called the MADAM scale, My Autonomy and Decision Making. And it says people agree and disagree to statements like, my doctor or midwife told me I had to make a decision about something. They explained the options for care. They explained the risks and benefits to me. They took time to help me understand the information. Mm-hmm. I had enough time to consider those options, and that my decision was respected. Right. I was able to choose what I want. So they would agree and disagree to that. So they may agree. Strongly agree to one item and moderately agree or disagree with another item, but all together they get a score.
Okay.
And so the range of scores is from 7 to 42, meaning 42 is very high autonomy, 7 is very low autonomy. Mm-hmm. So that's how we can say that, in fact, this is what it looks like in Canada versus another place, or for this population versus another. Mm-hmm. What we found in Canada that it's not the same for every population as far as whether or not people have autonomy. Mm-hmm. And definitely disrespect and mistreatment also. So recently we've published a study led by an Indigenous researcher, Dr. Wanda Phillips-Beck. And she, in the analysis that we did with just the quantitative items, which is the numbered items, we found that 63% of the Indigenous participants experienced at least one form of mistreatment.
That's
high. So 51% for everybody, but 63% for people who self-identified as Indigenous.
Yeah.
And nearly 75% experienced disrespect. So they, you know, described experiences being ignored, being left unattended, denied care, treated without consent, or verbally mistreated. Mm-hmm. We did also have a validated measure of discrimination, And this was for everybody answered it. So it was, you know, have you heard someone joking or laughing about you? Did, you know, did they, you know, use a name to call it? There's somebody, one of the other researchers in the world, created these lifetime discrimination experiences that people have. Mm-hmm. And it's probably not a surprise to say that the people who experience those things that happen that aren't happening to other people, mm-hmm. being treated differently, are reported more by people with disabilities, people who are racialized, people who are indigenous, people who have a substance use or incarceration history, people who are gender or sexual minoritized. That is known and kind of not that it should happen.
Yep, of
but
course.
Because that measure is there, we can now connect it to the experiences in childbirth. And, mm-hmm. you know, these experiences have lasting impacts on the health and well-being of children and families. Absolutely. And undermine trust in the healthcare system.
Absolutely. And so as we're coming to a little bit of a close here, I'm curious as to, like, after the project concluded, what would you say are some solutions?
The path forward, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I would say we did find that culture-centered care, so while we don't have enough providers, healthcare providers, or even researchers from underrepresented backgrounds, we can, as a health system, learn more about indigenous-led and indigenous ways of delivering care. We found that it didn't just benefit indigenous people, but everybody. Everyone benefited from indigenous midwifery model of care, which is a continuity model, mm-hmm. a relationship-based model. Mm-hmm. And nurse practitioners, physicians, you know, also having services closer to home. Mm-hmm. So relocation is very, very traumatic and difficult for people, and that's a health system's disrespect.
Of course.
We found that it's important to create these culturally safe and respectful environments by ensuring that providers have the training and time and resources to build trusting relationships, mm-hmm. and to support informed decision-making. That may look like accommodating access to elders and knowledge keepers or ceremony or traditional practices for mm-hmm. certain communities. It may just mean that the funding models for all types of providers who interact with the family allow for either the main provider or other providers to have the time to engage in those conversations and information
Absolutely.
Giving. I think there's also a need for accountability, strengthening that accountability across the health system so that cultural safety, anti-oppression, anti-racism is part of professional leadership so that we reward leadership that goes
Absolutely.
In that way.
Absolutely.
And then establish clear mechanisms to make sure that people can report and address mm-hmm. these things when they happen.
Absolutely. My goodness, we could talk forever. but sadly, we're coming to a close, guys. Dr. Saraswathi Vadam, I want to thank you so much for shedding insight on this national study and also talking about its importance and then also talking about solutions, because I think, you know, when I cover certain topics, we talk about the issue so much, but we don't always shed any kind of, you know, conversation around the solutions. So I appreciate that. I'm curious, if people wanted to get in touch with you, are you easily reachable by email?
Yeah, my lab is very much on the web. It's called birthplacelab.org.
Awesome.
And we do have a hub of researchers and community members and clinicians all around the country who are working on the solutions.
Yes.
It's called the Justice and Equity in Perinatal Services Hub. And so you can also find the link to that and join the hub and join the movement to change experiences.
I thank you so much. I am going to be including links in the show notes today so that people, if you are listening on the go, you are able to connect. Again, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And just like that, we are officially at the end of the show. Up next is Democracy Now! And if you're a listener of Speak Up, tomorrow host Jesse is going to be back with some interesting stories and music. And to play us out, we are going to listen to, let's see. Ooh, let us listen to Michelle David and the True Tones with Soul Women.
Life to all who needs to inhale. My womb carries light, dark, and everything in between. I'm the essence of the sun, the mystery of the moon, the depths of the oceans and flows of the sea. Each line I paint with the colors of prisms that infinitely expand and beyond the scope of this universe. We are the gift that God gave. When I speak, you see my soul. You hear my soul. You feel my soul. The valleys. I'm the mountains that have endless peaks. I'm simple, yet the complexity of me is vast.